our vice chair to help out with that. Thank you, Dana.
Thank you.
Well, you guys are in for a treat tonight. I got to meet Gary at one of these meetings about 6 years ago when he talked about his brand new speaker company that he and his partner were putting together. And I was so impressed with that, I thought, man, maybe we can get him back. So we're fortunate to have him back tonight. He has a degree in mechanical engineering and spent quite a bit of time designing printers and whatnot. And then he and his partner decided to do Vanatu, Rick, who's here with us. And let's see, is there anything else people need to know? And he's going to talk to us tonight about how to design a speaker from the beginning with,
In the beginning.
In the beginning, what would you do?
I don't know.
Here you go.
I don't know what I would do.
He's got a mic.
I really got a mic, so. I think I'm too loud. So, I'm going to try not to be too intimidated because I heard a few people out here are loudspeaker designers. So, if I say anything that you disagree with, you can, you know, quietly guffaw. And if you have any questions, you can certainly ask as we go along here. Dana invited me to come talk and a few months ago. And I think I've been here twice over the years talking. I only make one or two meetings a year because, you know, between wife and kids and jobs and everything else, it's hard to get here. But I think I maybe came and talked to the group twice in the past, and I talked about our company, Vanatu, and how we went about creating the business and getting stuff built in China and getting it sold here and all that. And I thought, gee, you guys don't want to hear that. You've heard that before. At least somebody who was here had heard it before. And so I asked Dana what I should talk about, and he says, oh, I don't know. You're an interesting guy. You'll come up with something. I thought, gee, thanks. There's no pressure there. but I thought, well, you know, I self-identify as being a speaker designer, and so I should do something on that topic. And for me, one of the hard things in speaker design is kind of knowing where you're going to end up when you start. You know, if somebody says you want a speaker, gee, I want it to be big and I want it to sound good, well, then I got to have a lot of bass and, you know, but I'm not sure exactly what that means. So I kind of sat down and started doodling, and after a couple of weeks, I thought, gee, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to write a white paper that describes this and I'm going to present it to the group. And predominantly, my association with the AES over the years has been through the Audio Engineering Society Journal. The Journal of the AES has published just about everything on speakers that ever mattered, and I'm a self-taught speaker designer, mostly from things from the journal. And so what I did for tonight was I wrote a little white paper for you guys that's on a topic of my own creation about speakers, and I'm going to present it to you in a PowerPoint. So,
that's
Vanatu. With a capital V. It's V-A-N-A.
How do you spell that?
He's my straight man. Okay, click on the PowerPoint icon at the bottom there. And then if you go up to the slide, hit the slideshow tab in the top.
Hang on, current slide.
Okay. So what we're going to talk about is, I called it bass reflex performance envelope. I'll talk about what bass reflex means in a minute, but what performance envelope means is the intent of this paper and spreadsheet you'll see at the end is it's going to answer the question that I think most of us want to know when we start working on a speaker, which is how loud will it play, how low will it go, how big a box does it need, and how much power does it take? Those are sort of the outline of the things you really need to know. And I don't know about any of you that designed a speaker, but usually I don't know that till I'm almost done, and if I don't like it, I got to go start over again. So I tried to come up with a way where you could outline all that stuff at the beginning so that when you headed down the path, you'd have a good idea where you're going to end up. So what is bass reflex? Okay, it's kind of an archaic term that has been around, I think, since probably the 40s that applies to what nowadays we more commonly think of as a ported speaker. I used it here because a ported speaker and a passive radiator, if you know what that is, are almost the same thing, and I think you can call them both bass reflex, so I wanted to use a term that I think covers both of them. I hear a lot of people describe how a ported speaker works, and most of what I hear described, I think, is just flat out wrong. So I want to spend a couple minutes just describing what a ported speaker actually does. Is that of interest to anybody?
Yeah.
Okay. So I got a couple different slides. We might have to jump back and forth to get through it, but go back to the first one there. So a ported speaker, you have a driver that can move in and out to, you know, put pressure in the box or air out, and then there's a hole in the box or a port, which is usually just a round tube in the box, that air can flow in and out of as well. Okay, I think it makes probably pretty clear sense to everybody that if you take this driver at real low frequencies and you push the cone out, that's going to create a vacuum in the box and air is going to rush into the box through the hole in the port. Kind of makes perfect sense that would happen. What isn't so obvious is what's going to happen as you start increasing the frequency that you're driving that piston in and out with, the speaker in and out with. As you start increasing the frequency, something weird happens. And instead of them being opposite in phase, one going out and one going in, at a high frequency, you end up with them basically going in the same direction at the same time. What happens is the air in the port, which is being driven by the pressure created by the speaker moving in and out, it just can't keep up and it kind of lags it and it slowly falls behind until they actually are in phase. What that looks like on a math curve is on the next plot. Okay, we'll start over here with the phases. So phase means are they going together or are they going opposite of each other? So at real low frequencies, down here at low frequencies, you can see these two things are about 180 degrees out of phase. That means when the speaker is going out, the air in the port's going in. They're going in opposite directions. But as you start increasing the frequency and you get to a high frequency, they're going together. And in the middle zone, something kind of weird happens. Okay? Something you might not expect is that as you increase the frequency, you get to a frequency where the mass of air in the port will vibrate against the air stiffness of the box. When the air moves into the port, it compresses the air in the box. That wants to force it back out. There's a resonant frequency there. You are all very familiar with that resonant frequency. And I want to thank you for my demo. You encouraged me to bring along a demo. I had to empty it last night for the demo. That right there is the Helmholtz resonance. That's air going in and out of the top of this thing, resonating with the stiffness of the air in the tube, air inside the box. In the example we have here, this resonance is at 100 hertz. And what happens is at 100 hertz, the displacement of the driver takes a big dip at the frequency where the resonance of the port is. And at higher frequencies, it goes up again. And the displacement of the port, the air going in and out of the port, is really high at low frequencies because the port's usually smaller diameter than the speaker. So if the speaker is big, you push it in a little bit, you get a lot of airflow out of the port. As you start increasing the frequency, the displacement of the air in the port starts dropping again because it can't quite keep up, and at high frequencies it doesn't do much. That's technically what's really going on. I don't know if that helps explain it really well or not, but that's technically what's going on. So you have these two surfaces that are moving. You have the cone surface of the speaker moving, and basically the air flowing in and out of the port, it looks like a surface the size of the port that's moving in and out as well. So how much sound does a moving surface generate? In speaker design, you usually start off assuming that your speaker is on an infinitely big wall and you have a round piston moving in and out. And even if that isn't what it looks like in real life, that's kind of the starting assumption, because acoustics is a horribly mathematical subject, and most things in real life that you might want to know, you can't actually solve. You can solve this one and get real answers out of it. So the sound generated by a piston moving on a wall is a function. You can look at it either as the displacement of the piston, the velocity of the piston, or the acceleration. They all give you the same answer. But what you see if you look at the displacement is it's a function of the area. S is the area of the piston, and X is the displacement of the piston. If you take an area times a displacement, that's a volume. Okay? So how much sound you get out of it is a function of how much volume of air you're moving and the frequency squared. That becomes important because you have all these moving surfaces and you have to add them up. If you add them up, you get to the next slide. Okay? So that first slide we saw where we had the phases and displacements of the two surfaces, the port and the driver. If you add up those using the equations in the last page for how much sound is generated, you get something like this. And this is a nicely behaved one here. Okay? And what you see is at low frequencies, the port sound comes up and hits a peak at that resonance we talked about and then decreases at high frequencies. The driver kind of does the same thing. It's about the same as the port down here. It dips at the point where the port resonates because that holds back the driver from moving, and then it rises. At low frequencies, so the overall sound you get of the two is by adding them up, and that's the black line, okay? That's the sum of the two. Well, at low frequencies, the sum of them is less than either one of them individually because, again, they're moving out of phase, so they partially cancel each other out. So at low frequencies, the output is actually less than either one of them would be individually. Above the resonant frequency, when they start moving together, the output is greater than either one of them individually because they're now starting to move in phase, but since the port starts dropping, it doesn't put out very much anymore. At higher frequencies, basically all the sound comes out of the woofer. So that in a nutshell is kind of how bass reflect works. I don't know if that was helpful, but that's the basic story. So.
Quick question, just for clarification. So you said that at the higher frequencies, only what was coming out of the speaker as opposed to output, is that the distinction?
Yeah. When the frequency, you go back there. When the frequency gets high, so the red line is the output of the port, okay? It peaks at this resonant frequency of the port and then starts decreasing as the frequency goes up. And once you get an octave or two above that resonant frequency, virtually all the sound is coming out of the actual driver. The port isn't making much sound anymore, unless it has a resonance or something in it that you don't want. But by the time you get to high frequencies, pretty much all the sound's coming out of the driver. At the resonant frequency, pretty much all the sound's coming out of the port.
So, Gary, would 100 hertz be the box tuning frequency on that, the FB?
Yes. This is great having I'll talk about you later. I love it's really nice to have a crossover of people from the Audio Society and the Audio Engineering Society here at the same time. I really like this because I've always thought that those two groups should spend more time together. They have so much in common. So it's nice to have some crossover. So the secret to making all that work is you have to find a way to get the motions of the air and the port and the woofer to be doing what you want so they can add up to that nice curve we were just seeing. And the idea of doing this goes back quite a while. A guy named Turris had a patent on it in 1932 for a ported box, but it was another 30-some years until somebody actually had a decent mathematical model of how it worked. Thiel in 1961 had a good understanding of it. And back in those days, no engineers had calculators, much less computers. And there was a lot of work that was done on electrical filters in the 1960s, mostly from telephone companies, I think. And people understood electrical filters pretty well. Thiel's inspiration was he was able to look at it and say, gee, if you look at the speaker in a certain mathematical way, it looks a lot like an electrical filter, and everything we know about electrical filters we can apply to it. And we have these different types of filters with different shapes and how they work and all that. And gee, we can think about them that way. And that's where this idea of alignments and response shapes came up with, because they had these known filters and things that they made them fit. Richard Small in the 1970s published a big series of articles in the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society, where he took Thiel's work and expanded it, and the combination of those two things became what's known as the Thiel-Small model, which is the basic model of how sealed speakers work, ported speakers, everything is kind of built around that. Nowadays, there's a lot fancier models than those, but those are kind of the basic models that everybody's used. They work well, and they're reasonably accurate. They don't make a lot of common sense because they were done by electrical engineers in the 1960s that didn't have computers. And they do things like call the mass of your moving speaker a capacitor, and a spring is an inductor, and they have things that are just kind of hard to wrap your head around. So I rewrote those in the last 10 years in a language that a mechanical engineer like me can understand, where everything actually has its own units and behaves the way you expect it to. And the nice thing is it's easy to mathematically optimize the kind of things I did. If you are a speaker designer, you know the Thiel small model is considered a small signal model. It's the measurements you make when you measure the parameters. The speaker is barely moving. You don't want it going through large displacements because speakers are really nonlinear. They don't do the same thing at big displacements they do at little ones. So the model is always considered to be a small signal model. In the paper I'm presenting here, we're going to say screw that. We're going to call it valid at large signals. There are some nonlinear models you can use, but they're really complicated and they don't allow you to do some of the things I've done here. So in my experience, it's probably not that bad of a thing to say that you can take that small signal model and extend it to large displacements. And actually, I was working with Dana on this a couple years ago, asked him if I could do that. He's like, no, you can't do that. And so I went and measured a bunch of stuff and concluded that, gee, the thing that really varies the most is the stiffness of the driver. It looks a lot less stiff when it moves a lot than it does just a little bit. In fact, it usually is about half as stiff at large excursions than his little ones. If you go back and put that in the actual model, that says you're going to get about a 3 dB error. When you look at what the overall model is, 3 dB is not much. And so I think it's not right. It's an assumption that's not right. But it's defensible, and I don't think it's off by all that much. In my own personal testing, there's a test that you use for subwoofers that helps you figure out how loud and how low they'll play. It's called the CEA 2010 test. I've run tests on stuff that I've built using this basic idea of extending a small signal model to large things. And generally when I run it, it's pretty close to what the model says you get. And usually actually I get a little better output than the model says. So it's better than doing nothing. It gives you an idea of what's going to go on. It's not quite right, but it's an assumption we're going to go with. The other thing we're going to do is we're going to, when these Teal and Small came up with all these different response and filter shapes, they had all these different types of filters and things, and we're going to pick just one of those. We're going to pick the one that's called the Butterworth Fourth Order High Pass, or B4 for short. And we're going to pick that because I'm going to argue that of all of them, it's the best one. And lots of people would argue that that's not right, but I'm just going to say it's the best one. The reason Butterworth one is famous is for a given set of constraints, it's the lowest crossover or F3 frequency you can get of all of them with minimum amount of ripple or no ripple in the passband. It has... Mike?
Gary, are we talking about a 24 dB per octave?
Yeah. That's what fourth order is. In the other, you're going to see it. You're going to see it again here in a second. But that's what fourth order is. It's 24 dB per octave. So it has the lowest crossover frequency or F3 frequency of anything that doesn't have ripple in the passband. It has pretty good transient response. When you work out all the details, it takes reasonable box size, reasonable amounts of power. In the real world, if you're designing a system or you want to take something like this and say, gee, can I go buy a speaker that will allow me to build something like Gary's proposing, there are a lot of speakers on the market that are designed with parameters that are pretty close to the Butterworth, since it's a popular one. And for what I'm doing here, it has some really handy mathematical properties that you couldn't arrive at what I'm going to show you without assuming this. So, and in fact, this is the curve you're looking at just a minute ago. That was a Butterworth curve. I didn't say it at the time. And yeah, Mike, so what happens down here at low frequencies is the port and the woofer are both changing at 12 dB per octave. But since they're canceling each other out, the sum, which is the black line, actually decreases at 24 dB per octave, and in the filter world, each order of a filter gives you a 6 dB per octave change. So this is a fourth order filter, gives you a 24 dB per octave change. That's a common feature of really any ported speaker if you get low enough in frequency. You can have other filter types won't have this nice smooth curve that we see here in the sum. You can have ones have big sags or big peaks in them. So the nice thing about the Butterworth is really well behaved, and when I build systems like this, they sound really good to me. So that's kind of the basics how we're getting there. One of the questions we're trying to answer is how loud it's going to play. Okay. There's two physical limits of the driver and the port that are going to limit how loud you can play. For the driver, it's going to be, well, obviously its size, and then how far it can move, right? Because in that equation that we saw for sound pressure, it had the area of the driver, the frequency squared, and the displacement of it. So the size and the displacement of it is going to limit how loud the driver itself can play. When you get to the port, it's not so much the displacement of the air of the port, but it's the velocity of the air going through the port. If you try to push air out of a port too fast, it starts making obnoxious noises. It starts making funny whistling noises and other things that you don't want. And what the absolute limit is, I don't know, people can argue that. A number I've seen used a lot is 20 meters a second for maximum air velocity, and that correlates pretty well with things that I've built and measured. It seemed to be right around that zone that they stop working well. So that's the number we're going to use here. And those things are, in a real speaker, those things change with frequency. The limits are there, but they are functions of frequency.
Just a quick question. What did you use to measure your air velocity in your port?
Did I ever measure it? I don't think I ever actually measured air velocity, but you measure the sound output level, and you know what velocity that correlates to. And so at a sound output level, when it started falling apart, it was at a velocity that's equivalent to right around there. Okay. So I don't know that I actually measured the velocity itself, but I measured the sound level and correlated that back to the velocity. And that's about where it started sounding crummy. So it's in that zone. So the nice thing about this Butterworth fourth order that we're going to pick is that it has some mathematical properties that we can count on that makes it easy to... it makes the math kind of fall apart and makes it easy to do. So the next slide shows you what's... So we'll go back to the motions of the woofer, the driver, and the port, okay? In this case, the earlier plot I showed you displacements of both of them. In this case, it's the displacement of the woofer, or the driver, and the velocity of the port, because those are the two things that are going to limit us. Displacement limited on the driver, velocity limited on the port. This is the same thing we saw before. It's the 100 hertz minus 3 dB frequency of a B4 system. Okay. Every Butterworth fourth order system is going to have a plot that looks just almost exactly like this. They could be a little bit different at real low frequencies depending on your box losses and some damping and things. But up in the range you care about, they're all going to look like this. Okay. They're always going to have a peak in the velocity of the air in the port that happens at a ratio of 0.87 times the 3 dB frequency of the system. The excursion of the woofer is always going to peak at 1.43 times the F3 of the system. Now, you notice the woofer has really big excursions down here at low frequencies. Almost all of us has had the experience of you put a warped record on your turntable with your ported speaker and the woofer cone starts doing this. Okay, the assumption is you have a way of dealing with that. You have a filter or some way you're not gonna worry about the fact that way down here there's really big excursions in the woofer. We're going to concentrate above the passband as being the things we really care about. So the nice mathematical properties of this that makes it all easy to get to is the observation that, we only need to know two frequencies. We really only need to know one frequency. What is the F3 frequency of the system? If we know that, and we know it's a B4 system, we know what frequency the port has its maximum velocity, we know what frequency that the driver has its maximum excursion. When we go back and look at the plot we saw earlier for the output of those two, we know how much output each of them has at those frequencies. The port, right here, is 3.6 dB down from, if we call this level up here the passband maximum output of the system, the port is 3.6 dB less than that at its maximum output. And the driver at its maximum displacement here, which limits its output, happens to be 5.9 dB down. That's always going to be true for any Butterworth fourth order system. The only thing that's going to change is what this frequency is, okay? So if you have a system that has a frequency of 50 hertz instead of 100 hertz, those numbers are going to be half that. If it's twice that, it's going to be twice that, but it's going to scale up and down linearly. That happens to be really nice because it just makes the math of everything fall apart. You can make some great assumptions. So, am I boring everybody to death yet?
I do have a question. Are those the DBD at F3 down points of the driver and the port, is that what defines a Butterworth? Is that what makes a Butterworth? Or is that a characteristic of some larger definition?
Basically, it's that shape we were seeing in the response curve. This basic shape right here, the fact that it is really flat right here, and it's a very nice smooth roll off, and it's 3 dB down at the frequency that the port is tuned, that's the characteristic of the Butterworth. And some of this stuff is covered in a lot more detail in the actual paper. So at the end of this, Rick's going to put on the website copies of the paper, the PowerPoint you're looking at, and some spreadsheets you're going to see. So all that stuff will be described in a little more detail there. But another nice thing about the Butterworth is there's three frequencies that you kind of care about in a system. It's the resonant frequency of the driver, the minus 3 dB frequency of the system, and the tuning frequency of the box and the port. And in a Butterworth system, those three are all basically the same number. And that's another nice mathematical part of it that makes it fall apart and makes it easier to analyze. Dan, you got a question?
Maybe you just answered this, but does the part's construction or shape or materials or texture do anything to change any of this stuff?
Not much.
Size?
The answer is mostly no. We're going to get into port size and driver size here in a second. For the most part, you see slot ports, you see round ports. There's reasons why you might use one over the other, but for the most part, the answer is no. They're not that different. So, so port now. Tim?
On this system, do you describe this this Butterworth filter as having a specific crossover frequency, like a 90 or 100?
Yeah, well, the F3 frequency, where it's 3 dB down, that's sort of its characteristic. So if you know it's Butterworth and you know it's F3 frequency, you basically know everything about it. That is enough to describe it. It's fourth order, it's 3 dB down on a certain frequency, and it's Butterworth, that tells you everything about the shape of it. So the 3 dB, that F3 frequency I keep referring to, that's kind of the key number in this whole thing.
So this is 3 dB down at 100?
In everything you've seen, I've been using 100 just because that's a nice round number that's easy to look at. And when they say, you know, there's a ratio of 0.87 and 1.43 and all that, it's just a nice number to use. But it can be any number. You can design a system around any number. So how loud will it play? Well, let's talk about the port, okay? The port is limited by its velocity. The maximum velocity is 20 meters a second. And the system will play 3.6 dB louder than the maximum that the port can play at. It's 20 meters a second, right? That's what we saw in that other curve. So if you take all that and you plug it into the equation we had for how much sound can a piston on an infinite wall put out, you know, the equation looks like this, okay? It says how much output the port can put out as a function of the 3 dB, minus 3 dB system of the system, and the diameter of the port in inches. I've used a really mismatch of units where I got some things in meters and some things in inches, because when we get to drivers, they're typically specified in how big they are in inches, and we all know how big ports are in inches. So if you go to the next thing, we'll see what that equation we just looked at looks like, okay? So this is kind of nice. On this side over here, we have how loud it'll play, how much sound can a port put out, versus what is the minus 3 dB frequency of the system it's in. And each of these lines is for a different diameter of port. So the bottom line is for a 1-inch port, and the top line is for an 8-inch port, okay? If you want to have a system that can put out 120 dB at 20 hertz, that would be right up in here. Say, gee, it would take an 8-inch diameter port to put out 120 dB at 20 hertz. That's why you don't see a lot of systems that put out really high sound pressure levels or really low frequencies, because it takes a heck of a big port to do it. So that's basically what the port does in the system. We can come up with a similar thing for the driver, okay? If you look at the driver, now we have to know, remember we had to know how big was the, oh, sorry, Gary.
Or Rick. Will you talk at some point about multiple ports?
No.
Okay.
When you do multiple ports, they end up looking like one port eventually. So driver output, when we're talking about driver, we said it's how much volume of air it can displace. Okay, so that's what the area of the cone is, and then how far it can move. I kind of wanted to come up with an easy way of getting my arms around, gee, what is it that you need to do to put out a certain sound? So I went and looked at a bunch of commercial drivers of different sizes, and in the U.S., there's kind of standard sizes. The standard sizes you see are 4-inch, 5.25, 6.5, 8, 10, 12. There's different sizes that are kind of standards. So I went and looked at the area of different drivers that are advertised as being 4-inch and 5.25 and the different sizes, and I plotted them on this curve, and then I curve fit a line through them. And you end up with a nice little equation that says, gee, the area of a cone of a driver based on the advertised size that it's sold as being is this little equation here. So now I don't have to know the area of the driver. You just tell me how big a driver, and I give you a good idea what the area is. Now you need to know how far the driver can move. Okay, well, that's the X max that's published of the driver. Most drivers have a published X-max, which is how far the thing can move under good control before either the suspension or the motor. It doesn't work well anymore. And I totally made up this line. Okay, you can argue with that all day long. But I said for high-quality, hi-fi drivers, this is about what you'd get usually for an X-max. Some are going to be more than that. Some are going to be less than that. You multiply those two together, and you get that volume displacement of the driver as a function of its size, which we have on X-curve.
Does X-max peak, peak to peak?
Peak. Generally speaking, X-max is spec'd as peak. Sometimes you see it peak to peak, and when you're reading spec sheets, you got to be careful because there isn't an absolute standard, but if there is a standard, it's peak. So the equation we had on the other line is this middle line here in the middle. I'm calling that hi-fi drivers, is that middle line. What's going to vary, if you look at a subwoofer driver, that equation for how much cone area there is a function of the size, that's not going to really change. But for a subwoofer driver, you might have about twice as much X-max as I showed, so you might have the red line on top. Pro audio drivers, we always think of pro audio drivers as having high output. Well, they have high output, but they don't generally have high output at low frequencies. They usually actually have less X-max than a good hi-fi woofer. So if you say you have half as much X-max, a pro audio driver might be down here. We're going to concentrate the blue line in the middle as being our hi-fi driver kind of thing that we're looking at. If we do the same thing with that line that we did with the port, we get the equation that was on the previous page there. You get this equation for how much sound you can put out as a function of the F3 of the system and the size of the driver, advertised in inches, which is now really simple. And then you get the next plot, which says, gee, this looks just like the plot we had for the port. Over here we have how loud can the system play. Over here we have how low the system can play. And here we have different driver sizes. So if this says you can have a 4-inch driver that can put out 90 dB at 30 hertz if you tune it right. And if you wanted that 120 dB at 20 hertz we talked about earlier, even an 18-inch driver can't quite get you there. Unless you maybe had an 18-inch sub with that extra excursion, which would up these curves a little bit. So it gives you a good idea of how loud a driver can get. So in my book, that's actually kind of remarkable. Okay, we have two curves that are give you a really good idea in a hurry. If I want to play a certain loudness, I want to hit 105 dB, and I want to play down to 30 hertz, I can look at the curve over here for the driver, and I can say, gee, 30 hertz, 105 dB, that 8-inch driver crosses that line. A good 8-inch driver will give me 105 dB at 30 hertz. And if I go over to this line and I say the same thing, and I'll say, oh, it needs to be about a 2¾-inch diameter port, I'm almost done. It's those two curves and what I want to do, gee, the design is almost done. I haven't even looked at anything yet.
Vance Dickinson is crying.
So that's the first half of the thing. We started out saying we want to know how loud, how low, how big a box, and how much power. We've answered, the first part about how loud and how low, what it takes to do that. Okay, what we don't know yet is the box size and how much power it takes. We have to go to a totally different mindset to get to the next part, which I was stuck on this for a little while, but eventually I think I got it. So I love this term, the iron law. This is a term that came from the KLH Corporation back in the 50s or 60s. The H in KLH was Joseph Hoffman. And his buddy Henry Klaus, who is the K in KLH, wrote this article for Audio Magazine in March 1971 called Hoffman's Iron Law. And basically what the guys at KLH came up with when they were working on their acoustic suspension or sealed speakers back in the day was Hoffman realized that he could get a speaker that could play low in a small box, but he couldn't make it efficient. If he wanted to make it more efficient, he either had to make the box bigger or he had to raise the minus 3 dB frequency. He couldn't get what we would all like would be a small box that plays really low that's really efficient. And he just couldn't get that combination. He says, these three parameters, the size of the box, how low it plays, and the efficiency, they must all be in the same equation. He didn't know exactly what that equation was, but he knew they were all in the same equation, and if you picked two of them, you didn't get to pick the third one. You were going to get what you got. So this 1971 article kind of described that. When Small came along a few years later, he actually put some math to it. And if you go back and read through Small's papers and apply them to our Butterworth fourth order system that we're assuming here, you can come up with an equation like this that says here's how much sound pressure you can get out of the system as a function of the minus 3 dB frequency to box size. And in this case, we're not so worried about efficiency, we're more worried about power. So you can reconvert it and look at electrical power you're putting in. If you take this equation that's based on Small and you tie it into my equation we had a minute ago for all those curves for sound pressure versus sizes, you can come up with an equation for the electrical input power as a function of the minus 3 dB frequency, the size of the driver, and the volume of the box. So there was quite a bit it took to get to that, but I'm not going to dredge you through all the mathematics of it. But it's described a little more detail in the paper. And that's the second half, okay? First half took a little longer, second half is fast. So you can pick anything you want on the graph, but the power is going to vary a little bit, and there is no fixed design. Theoretically, you can design a box that has any volume. If you pick your how loud you want it to play and your minus 3 dB frequency, theoretically, you can have a box of any volume to do that. But as the box gets smaller and smaller and smaller, the power is going to go up and up and up. There is no one fixed design. So, gee, we wanted to come up with something simple, but now we're back to we kind of got a conundrum. What can we do? Let's just run through a quick design example to see what it might look like when you actually start thinking through what it's going to do. Let's say we want to design a system that would be a good consumer speaker. I would say if it had a minus 3 dB frequency of 30 hertz and could play 105 dB, that's pretty good. And in fact, I built a system like that, this little plug for the Audio Engineering Society. There's a speaker contest every 2 years. It's coming up this August. I built a speaker that was very much like that 2 years ago, entered it into the contest, and I lost to Howard here. That's why you're going to come up later. So. He made a very nice speaker. That speaker now resides at a friend of mine's house who's absolutely happy with it, and it rattles his walls. And in fact, it had 8-inch driver in it. So when you look in the graph, you'd say 8-inch driver can do that, 2 3/4-inch port. We're almost done. All we need to know is how big a box and how much power. So we plot the equation for box size versus power, and it looks like this. Again, this is going to look different for every driver. This is for the combination of an 8-inch driver with 105 dB output and a 30 hertz F3. We get this curve looks like this, okay? If you start shrinking the box, the power goes up and up and up, okay? I took a look at this and said, I don't know, 20 liters? 28 liters is 1 cubic foot, which would be 12 inches on a side if you made it as a cube. So 20 liters, that's a pretty small box. If I get 105 dB at 30 hertz out of a box that big, that sounds pretty good. And it only takes 172 watts. Power's cheap nowadays. You can get an 8-inch driver, you can handle 172. That's kind of a sweet design. So that would be a pretty nice design. Only thing we really have left is to figure out how long the port has to be, and we still don't really know the driver parameters. So let's take a look at what port it takes to make that happen. Well, there's an equation for the box tuning, and Rick, when you asked about more than one port, that equation will look a little different with multiple ports. You have to take the error of both of them in and stuff. But for a round port in a box, the box tuning equation looks like that. If you apply this to our design example, something Howard asked earlier, the box tuning frequency for our Butterworth system is the same as the resonant frequency of the driver, which is the same as the minus 3 dB frequency. So we had a 30 hertz F3, we have a 30 hertz box tuning frequency. So we put 30 hertz box tuning frequency in there with our 20 liter box, and we come out with a port that's 23 inches long. But we just said we had a box that was less than a foot on the side. Now Dana says, gee, you just let the port stick out of the box. He's not trying to sell too many things yet, so. Well, now we got a bit of a problem. We said we could pick anywhere on that box volume versus power curve. There's no constraint except, maybe we can't fit the port. Well, how big a port can you fit? Okay. So far, everything you've seen is stuff that I've made up, so I'm going to make this up too. Okay. Go back. You're getting too jumpy. So if we say that our, in this case, our box was about a cubic foot, if it's 12 inches on every side, the cube root of the volume would give you the size of a cube that was equal dimensions on all sides, right? Mm-hmm. So if you take the cube root of the box volume, that would be a box equal dimension on all sides. And if you then stick a port in it, you can't have it go all the way from the front to the back because you have to have a little bit of clearance where the port can get air in and out. And most things tell you you want about one port diameter of clearance on the back. So my approximation for what's the longest port you can fit says take the cube root of the box minus one port diameter, and that's about what you're going to be able to fit in the box. Now, there are people who make curved tubes and all kinds of stuff you can do, and they can work, but more conventional design, straight tube in the box going front to back. That's about as long as a tube as you're likely to fit. You can take and plot that length of, you can use that as a constraint to figure out how, what the smallest box is that you can tune to the frequency you want. And again, I've spent a lot more time looking at this than you guys have, so I don't expect you to remember every detail of how we got here, but we had a fixed port size. You know, we needed a 2 3/4 inch diameter port to get our 105 dB at 30 hertz. So you tie all those together and you can come up with a solution that says, gee, here's the smallest box you can have that has a port that's no longer than this that'll tune you to 30 hertz with that size. And you can plot that on the curve for power that we saw a minute ago, and that'll say, gee, we wanted to have our 8-inch speaker with the 20-liter box, but in fact, this blue line up and down here is that solution that says this is the smallest box we can have that can fit the port that'll tune it to that frequency with the port size we need, okay? So we can't really make that 20-liter box with our port unless we want to give up performance. We can use a smaller diameter port, but then it won't play as loud. We can make the port shorter and raise the tuning, but then it won't play as low. We really can't get down in here with a port. Well, maybe you can curve it and do a bunch of other things.
Is it going to have a speaker stand?
he's gonna stick it out of the box. JJ? Yes, you can. You can, and people do that. Some of the Genelec subs that are out nowadays, they have a box that's kind of round, and they have a curve. It's a round tube, and then they got a curve all around the outside, but the port flows around. So there are ways to do it. But in general, if you're trying to fit a 23-inch port on a box of 12 inches on the side, it's going to take up a lot of volume, have a lot of bends in it, and then the air probably won't flow all that well, and it. You can kind of do it, but I would argue it starts falling apart on you in a hurry. Did I even mention passive radiators yet?
No.
Okay. At the beginning, we were talking about how base reflex works with the port and all that. A passive radiator is really just another speaker mounted in the box that doesn't have a motor on it, or the motor's not connected. So you have a cone and the suspension and all that, but there's no motor driving it. It behaves almost identically as a port. Everything we talked earlier about what the motions and everything is and their phases and how they work together, it's almost exactly the same thing. The only real difference is a passive radiator has some stiffness. You know, when you push its cone out, it wants to go back. Air doesn't really have that. And it has some damping. So there are a couple things a little bit different in a passive radiator than a port, but in the frequencies above the resonance and stuff we care about, they really look almost identically the same. And again, that's why I call them both base reflex.
Where is the passive radiator placed with respect to the primary drive?
It just has to share the same box space. So usually they're on it could be on the front side or the back side or on the side side. It could be anywhere in the box, but it has to share the internal air volume that the driver is compressing. So, you know, the simple thing is, you know, you take out the port and drill a bigger hole and put another thing the size of the driver in there as a passive radiator. And that behaves just about the same. Well, that allows you to get down in this zone because you don't have the problem not being able to fit the port. So in my world, in the Vanitu world that Rick and I delve in, We use passive radiators for that very reason. We have small boxes that we want to get a lot of bass out of. And trust me, I tried every way known to man, including JJ bent ports and slot ports and everything else, and I couldn't get anything to work well. You want to use a port because it's inexpensive. Or in the case of, you know, they're just downright cheap, okay? Passive radiators cost more money. They don't necessarily work better under all circumstances. I would argue that all things equal, a ported system is probably better if you can make it work. But if you want to get access to this design area down in here, you can't get there with a port. So you have to go to a passive radiator.
Real quickly, so a ported system, this design, it seems like you're assuming a square or cubic box and equal dimensions on all three sides, and the port is front-facing, right? And whereas you're saying now a passive radiator can be in the back or on the side.
Yeah, and you can put the port on. You can put the port on any side as well. When that little equation I came up with that said the cube root of the volume minus one port diameter, most speaker boxes are taller than they are wide, and the depth is sometimes narrower or sometimes deeper. But if you make the box taller than it is wide, then you can't make it a lot deeper because that volume is going to get too much. So that was just an approximation to come up with about how big a port can you fit. So the argument of this plot is, look, there are some very desirable design areas. You might like to design a system down in here. You might be willing to feed it more power to make a smaller box and get the same performance out of it. Going to be really hard to do with the port, or probably impossible. So this area down in here is the area you can access with a passive radiator. Anything up in here you can do with a port. So it gives you kind of a nice visual of, gee, when might be appropriate to use a PR versus a port. Any questions at this point? Is it kind of making sense?
Would you just say that last thing you just said again with regard to passive radiators versus ports and that curve?
Sure.
So where does it become advantageous to use that?
So in the case of this was for our 8-inch speaker that can hit 105 dB at 30 hertz, and we came up with this red line as being how much power it takes versus how big a box you have. And we said, gee, we want to tune this box to 30 hertz, and we want the port to be able to put out 105 dB. 40 liters is the smallest box that we can fit the port into comfortably. And so any box volume bigger than 40 liters, we can fit the port in and have room for it to fit and have clearances and everything. Okay. Any box volume smaller than that, we probably can't. So that line sort of becomes the demarcation line where you can do ported speakers on one side. The other side, you're going to have a hard time doing it. You might want to go to a passive radiator. So every...
This is kind of a new question.
No.
there's no kind of problem with phase cancellation if the PR is on the side or the back. You know what I'm saying?
If they were a really, really long ways apart, maybe. But for the most part, we're talking about low frequencies. You know, if you're at 50 hertz, your wavelength is, what, 20 feet long? And if they're 6 to 8 inches, 10 inches apart, there's just not enough distance between them to matter very much. If you made a really, really long tube or something, it might. But in the dimensions that we normally are associated with, it doesn't matter too much.
If you made your port too small... You have an ideal design. You come up with a really good ideal design. You made the port smaller. Is that going to give you about the same result as using too small of a passive radiator?
Yeah. I'm not sure why you'd want to use too small a passive radiator, but yeah.
Those contest speakers are like that. They each had an 8.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what's going on. It's just,
Yeah. In the paper, when I go through this, when you get to that point in the paper, and you use the same design example of the 8-inch driver, 30 hertz, 105 dB, in the paper, I say, okay, well, what happens if I want to use the 20-liter box? And how big a port can I really fit using that equation, and then what does that do to the performance? Or if I want to say that I'm willing to raise the F3, how much do I have to raise the F3 by to keep the output? So the paper shows you how you would solve that to what the downsides of going either way are on that. So I didn't put that in here because I wasn't trying to make it last forever.
Yeah, I got a quick question about linearity. This is obviously there's no feedback, there's no error correction. You design this thing, and it stays within some, I assume, some linearity up to a certain value, to a certain related to the SPL level. So, do you ever drive it beyond that to see? You know, I mean, like if you go beyond a certain power input, then all bets are off. This thing sort of collapses or falls apart.
So, if you take, you know, your most woofers, because we're, you know, I've used the term driver here most of the time, but we're really talking about woofers. If the Xmax that's published for them of how far they can travel, usually that's based on the magnetics of the motor. You've got this little voice coil moving in a magnetic gap, and when it gets to the end of the gap, it just kind of runs out of gas in a hurry. So up to the point where you're within the specified, the Xmax is usually a point at where the thing will put out maybe 10-ish percent distortion. So if you get much beyond that, it starts falling apart in a hurry. And there's no guarantee it's even going to sound great up at the Xmax, but much beyond that, it's going to just start sounding crummy.
What do you think about Baskin-King's approach to quick transducers where he actually does get error correction? Does that really improve, or does it?
I think I have heard the name, but I'm not familiar with the approach. There are approaches nowadays for correcting nonlinear distortions, and you know, you can put an accelerometer. Years ago, Velodyne made subwoofers with accelerometers for feedback, and you know, if you got enough power, you can override anything. But so there are error correction ways of doing things nowadays. There's a lot of work that Klippel out of Germany's done on nonlinear systems, how to correct them. A lot of that stuff's actually applied to a lot of really dinky speakers in telephones and stuff, you know. I'm not an iPhone guy, but I'm always stunned when my wife turns on her iPhone how loud that little speaker will play. And I'm not too sure they don't do some error correction things in there. So at this point, we haven't really talked about what the driver parameters are, but every driver in that you would pick on those curves has a different set of parameters. And there's no guarantee that any particular, just like we picked a point on our power versus box size curve that we really couldn't fit the port, there's no guarantee that any other curve you fit is going to come up with a driver that's physically realizable. You know, if you need a BL product of 50, you're just not going to get it. But the spreadsheet calculates those for you.
I'm just going to say, I don't think it applies to your box at all, but I have encountered some subs that actually, where the woofer moves 10% of the box volume, and that gets really interesting because your spring constant is changing level. But that's just, I think, what he may relate to what he's talking about nonlinearity.
Yeah.
Because in something like that, you have to handle the nonlinearity.
Yeah.
Or it gets very, well, I prefer not to build that, but I understand why you don't either.
There's ways of fixing that, but that gets kind of exotic and expensive, and you know. So there's a spreadsheet that calculates driver parameters. Go on. So look, what we started off with says is when you go to do design, the really big questions are how loud can the thing play, how low can it play, what kind of driver do I need? How big does the port need to be? I didn't mention that in the beginning, but that turns out to be important. How big does the box got to be and how much power is it going to take? Well, we came up with a pretty simple solution to kind of zero in on about what it takes in a hurry. There's no guarantee that you're going to design anything that looks exactly like this, but if you said, gee, my friend wants to have a disco speaker in his house, and he wants it to play at 110 dB, and he wants it to get down to 40 hertz to sound good, you can look at the curve and say, well, I know about what that's going to take. I can go find some drivers like that, and I can start modeling to see what I can get. And you know pretty quick about where you need to look to get there. And prior to doing this little bit of work, if you had asked me that, I would have had to go off and spend a couple days solving different things and thinking about it. I didn't know how to get to this answer in a hurry, but and you can get honed in to a pretty close answer in just a matter of a few minutes. So what Rick will have is a copy of the actual white paper that I wrote for you guys, a copy of the PowerPoint, and then there's four spreadsheets that go with this whole thing. One of them is just a spreadsheet of the B4 Lyman at 100 hertz, which is the thing we saw like three different times. It just shows that again and how it what it looks like. The one I'm going to show you is this middle one, which is basically has all those curves in there and allows you to plot that power versus box size curve and just a couple keystrokes and you can see the whole thing. And then there's two general purpose, the Vanatoo version, the Teal small models that run in Excel, one for a ported system and one for a passive radiator system. So if you were to use this first one and say, oh, okay, I can do about this, and then you went and found a driver that wasn't quite exactly that, you could plug it in one of these general purpose models and get a more accurate guess of what it would really do. So I'll answer any questions on this and then show you the spreadsheet, and then we can take our break.
Never built any speakers, but I'm going to go tomorrow. I've got some raw materials to build with my son. Take this information and actually try and build some speakers tomorrow.
Good man.
Besides the the drivers and the ports, what kind of material do you build the box out of usually? What's the best material for this?
I just use MDF. It's cheap. They're medium density fiberboard. It's cheap. Make sure and wear a dust mask. You'll die of lung disease if you breathe this stuff. But it's cheap and it works pretty well, and it doesn't like swell with temperature and stuff. So you know, and it's easy to glue. So
why medium, not high?
I can't find high. I mean, it's when I've looked for high stuff, it's like the phenolic things. I think if you could find it, I'd use it. But it's hard. I've never really found it when I've gone to the stores. So
there used to be a lumber yard up in the north end that I bought
from a chap. Yeah. Stage. You know, how thick you need depends how big a box you're going to build. If the bigger box, go thicker. So
I've got 15 inch drivers.
When you say 105 dB SBL, do you use some sort of dynamic range here? In other words, that would be peak. And what would be roughly, or do you calculate an average level below that, and what this really relates to is heat
buildup
in the woofer.
No, everything I'm talking about here is what's the maximum volume you can get out of the system before it falls apart. So at any volume less than that, you know, theoretically going to be fine. You have to make sure that, you know, if you come up with a system that says it's going to take 200 watts, you want to get a woofer that's designed to handle 200 watts so that it won't overheat. But in general, we're just talking about the peak levels the system can put out before it craps out. So,
do your models have a limitation in terms of box volume and driver size? So, for example, I work a lot with boxes that are like a couple meters down to maybe a quarter meter. You know, things that are in the smart speaker category.
My curve that I showed for the size of the cone versus the advertised size of the driver, that wouldn't be quite right, but when you go to the Teal small models that are there in Excel, that doesn't assume that. You can put in any size you want. So the answer, I think, is the mathematics of all of them are the same. They really aren't any different. There's no real size dependency, whether it's huge or small. It's basically the same set of equations doing the same thing. So. I used to see speakers like that. I don't see those very often anymore. But so let me quickly show you what this spreadsheet looks like, and then we can take our break. So the spreadsheet has two tabs. First tab has this plot that we saw earlier, which is the maximum system sound pressure level versus your system minus 3 dB frequency for different sizes of drivers. Okay, and you use this very slightly different than what I said before. Before I said you picked how loud and how low. Here you pick your driver size and your minus 3 dB frequency. That's going to give you how loud, because you're going to look at the plot and say, oh, well, I want to play about this loud, so I'll pick about this size driver. So what we said before is we had an 8-inch driver right here with a F3 of 30 hertz, and we were at about 105 dB because that's what you see right here on the plot. Okay, so you user plugs in these two numbers. It can be any two numbers you want that are anywhere within the range we're doing here. And you come down here to this next section, and this number right here tells you what the exact number is on the plot. So it wasn't 105 dB. It was 105.31, close enough. Here's your 2 3/4 inch diameter port, and here's the port area in meters squared. Now you need to know that calculation for the power versus the box size and what port fits in there. And unfortunately, you can't do that in Excel without a macro. At least I don't know how to do it without a macro, because you got to solve a 4/3 root of something that isn't an easy thing to do. Excel does it easily, but it takes a macro. So you hit this little blue button, and it calculates these parameters over here that tells you how big the box has to be. So before I said it was a 40-liter box, it's really a 39.4-liter box. And then it plots the curve over here for you. Shows you here's power over here. Here's the box volume. Here's our line that says down here we'd have to use a passive radiator. Over here we can use a port, and we'll pick the smallest box that we can use a port. Happens to be this 39.4-liter box. Below that, it calculates out what the driver parameters have to be, and they get spit out here for you automatically. I'm not going to go into great detail on how you run this, but you can come in at this section of the spreadsheet and say, well, I don't want to use that box volume. I do want to use a smaller box. You can put in the smaller box volume here, and it'll recalculate this for you, and it'll tell you what penalty you're going to pay for doing that. It'll say, well, you're going to use a smaller port. You're going to lose this much dB. So it'll do that for you. If you stick with the given design, you can just click on the next tab. It takes you to the ported Teal small model that automatically uploads the driver parameters that calculated in the other sheet onto this sheet, and voila, here's your design. I'm going to go back here for a second. On this curve, we're at a little under, looks like we're somewhere around 80-some watts there, kind of hard to read. It tells you down here somewhere exactly how much it is. Right here it says it's actually 87 watts, okay, right down here. When you get the next curve, next plot, these Teal small parameters have been uploaded in here. And this is what the, when I say the spreadsheets you get, there's also a Teal small solver. It looks just like this, except you can go in and change the parameters in it. All those things are uploaded here. Here's our nice response we get. Minus 3 dB down at 30 hertz, just like we wanted. For our 8-inch driver, we said it had a 6mm X-max, and that's its maximum displacement above the port frequency. Well, this line is it, and let me see right there, blue. Gee, there's 6mm, just like we said. We said the maximum port velocity would be 20 meters per second. That's the red line on this graph. Oh, look, it's 20 meters a second, just like we said. And here's the power curve, okay? Well, at low frequencies, it never actually gets to the 87 watts, but at high frequencies up here, by God, we're right about 87 watts, just like we said. So you can go in and change those things around. So for the sake of argument, Vanatu makes a transparent one encore speaker that has a 5 1/4-inch driver that plays to 48 hertz as minus 3 dB frequency. And in fact, it actually has a Butterworth fourth order response, kind of. A little more complicated than that, but if we put that in, 5 1/4-inch playing to 48 hertz, and we say calculate what it takes to do it, it comes back and says, oh, you need a 12-liter box, okay? And here's what that line looks like on the curve. Takes a 12-liter box and takes it about 50 watts to run it. I don't want to sell a 12-liter box. People don't want one that big. We forced it into a box that's only 4 liters, okay? We operate right down here at a 4-liter box and about 100 watts, and we're a little below this line. We don't get quite as much output as you possibly could. Actually, we don't have enough displacement in the passive radiator to really completely get everything. But we've taken the design and moved it down here. So that's what a passive radiator does for you. You can't do the port. So.
Can you translate a 12-liter box
into inches? Yeah, 12 liters is a little less than a half a cubic foot. So that would be about eight or 9 inches on a side. So somewhere in that range.
Water or what? What do you talk about liters?
Liters is a major volume. And it's, there's a mishmash of units I've used in the paper because of just the traditional way things have been specified. When you look on sheets for speaker specs, this thing they call the equivalent volume of the driver is almost always specified in liters. So I've used liters here. But the driver sizes are almost always specified in inches, so I used inches to be consistent with what you see in the industry. Personally, I prefer to always work in metric units, but, you know.
Oh, I was curious why the port length was highlighted. Is that just easier to see, or was there a problem when it's...
The reason that's highlighted is in here, it gets says shown with red highlight if it won't fit. Well, in this case, if this number is bigger than the number calculated, it'll highlight it red. In this case, they're basically the same, so it'll fit. But okay. I think there's the last decimal place somewhere, it's off a little bit, so it highlighted it red. I needed to give a little bit of margin, so if it's within like 5%, it won't highlight it. So, but it kind of is meant to draw your attention to it. If you come up with a design that, hey, that's not going to work for you, it'll highlight it for you and let you know. Nice. So.
Can you give the guy who's going to build a 15-inch speaker tomorrow some ideas to put in 15-inch?
I'll do that on the break. So,
okay.
Oh, but sure. Well, yeah, you'd have to know more about the speaker, but you know, if it's okay. If it's 15-inch speaker, and yeah, you want to play down to
30.
He wants to vibrate everything.
Well, there's no guarantee that his speaker follows any of the parameters we have here, right? So, again, this says you need a driver of that size, but it doesn't tell you what your teal small parameters have to be. And he's got fixed teal small parameters. The assumption of this model is that you can get any parameters you want. I have access to that because I got a factory in China to build it for me. You got to go buy something you can get commercially, and it may not have that, so... This says you need a 146-liter box, which is about 6 cubic feet. So that's a pretty big box. But you can play at 120 dB, so gee. I think that means some dunks. My mic just fell off, so. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, so.